3 days after the September 11th attack, 2012 attack on the US diplomatic compound in Benghazi, Libya, another attack occurred on a massive forward operating base called Camp Bastion in Helmand Province, Afghanistan, home to both US and UK forces. We didn't hear about this. One of the reasons why, well, we're going to explain the reasons why, because my next guest has written a thought-provoking and blows the lid off this story. The book is called Triumph Over the Taliban, The Untold Story of US Marines' Courageous Fight to Save Camp Bastion. It's by Gene McKinney, who joins us live on the line. Good afternoon from Spain. Good morning to you, I presume, somewhere in the US.
Yes, hi, how are you?
I'm very
good to be here.
I'm very good to have you with us. It's a story that we haven't heard about. And so for those, obviously, the US, the UK both had forces in Afghanistan during that period. Explain a little bit about perhaps, first of all, let's start with Camp Bastion itself, because to describe it, when you say camp, people kind of think, okay, well, it's maybe like a little bit of a fort or something, but actually it was quite huge.
Correct. Yes. Lieutenant James Terry, U.S. Army Commander, ISAF Joint Command, explains that in the foreword of my book, that it was a massive combined expeditionary forward operating hub. And it has three major national forces, the British, the U.S., and the Afghan forces. And so just to give you some perspective of the area of responsibility there, it was 38,000 square miles in the southern provinces, Helmand and Nimruz provinces in Afghanistan. And Camp Bastion was part of that, but there were 196 combat outposts and FOBs there. So the reason it was there, it was one of the most volatile areas in Afghanistan, primarily because of the poppy grown there and the opium sales that fueled the insurgency.
Because this was one of the things, wasn't it? One of the great sort of ironies of the fact that this supposed jihad against as they would see, the invading forces, the occupying forces of the US and the UK and the Afghans who were loyal to the regime, was the fact that this was all being funded, pretty much the counterinsurgency was being funded by opium.
Yes, it was largely funded by that. And, a lot of people don't understand this, that because they think of us as an invading force. We were actually invited there by the Afghan government to restore security to the region, because the Taliban and Al-Qaeda allies were a rebel group that were disrupting the ability for Afghans to live in peace, basically disrupting their economy, keeping girls out of school, even shutting off water in local villages. And so it was a peacekeeping force, as well as our U.S. ambitions to find bin Laden that they originally housed there. But when he left Afghanistan, then we were left with fighting the insurgency that was still there.
So,
and Camp Bastion itself, I will add, was about 40 square miles. And it had about 25 miles of fence lines. So that was a monumental challenge to defend.
40 square miles. I mean, that's basic. How many operating soldiers, airmen, Marines were actually, and British forces were actually in Bastion sort of full time then? I mean, how many, we're talking a couple of thousand? How many are talking?
Well, it was rotating. You know, they come in, come out, you know, as the units deployed. And there was, like I said, the three, the US, UK, and Afghan. And then there were 50 coalition nations as part of Operation Enduring Freedom that kind of went in and out of Afghanistan. And many of them rotated through there. Plus, there were hundreds of civilian contractors, third country nationals that would come in and do odd jobs on the base. And they were going in and out of the base daily.
What's your background in relation to this story then? I mean, how did you first hear about it? I mean, did you go to Afghanistan? What drew you in particular to this story?
Well, I had already been writing stories about active duty U.S. active duty personnel, showcasing, you know, their combat experiences and publishing in a local paper. And one of the pilots I interviewed knew about Bastion and said, if you want a good story, you should check this out. And so he introduced me to a couple of people that were there that had fought there that night. The Taliban breached the wire. And then once I started interviewing them, I realized, wow, this is a big deal. Why didn't we hear about this? I asked the same questions. And I'm an investigative mind. And so I kind of dug into it and then started interviewing more Marines that were actually engaged in the fight with the Taliban. And it became so amazing to me that I just felt like I had to tell the whole story. And then I stumbled onto some investigations because I asked the question, well, why did two U.S. Marine Corps generals get fired over this? And that's when I kind of dug up Pandora's box on what happened there.
Because the attack on Bastion comes, is it only a couple of days after the attack on the U.S. embassy in Benghazi, isn't it? And just explain, let's cast our mind back and just explain, Janine, if you can, what actually happened there.
Oh, in Benghazi?
Yeah.
Well, our ambassador was sent there, and they were at a diplomatic outpost. And he knew it was a very volatile region. He didn't have enough security of his own. And he only had less than a handful of security. And the insurgents there, which was a division of Al-Qaeda, were planning to attack. And they did. And the only thing, and unfortunately too late for the ambassador and Sean, his assistant, and then two security contractors that were actually hired to protect a secret CIA facility there that nobody really knew about. But if not for the security contractors, there would have been a lot more dead Americans. Mm. And so the Benghazi story actually helped inspire me to write Camp Bastion that happened 3 days later, because it was a similar thing of telling the fight from the perspective of those who were there actually fighting and all of the stuff that surrounded it.
So one of the things that has the first things that crossed my mind is when I read about this and handed the press notes on it, is this is an attack on a 40 square mile facility. It's, those were just a passing knowledge of Afghanistan will know Camp Bastion because, as you said, the British forces are there as well. And the lifeblood of any army, any force in a country where there are hostiles is intelligence, intel. And it would seem that this attack completely foxed the intelligence gathering services and really took those inside by complete surprise.
It did take them by surprise, but the intelligence, I can't even say what role intelligence played in this, because they got intelligence briefings every day, but I can tell you some other factors that played a role. So first off, even when, a force trains and trains and many times outthinks the enemy, they can't always predict what a determined adversary is going to do. But, however, the Marines of 3rd Marine Aircraft Wing, and they were led by Major General Mark Gurganis and Major General Greg Sturdivant, when they deployed to the base, there were blaring security gaps, not of their making. I can explain those. It was on the eastern perimeter where the American forces were housed. It was wide open territory. But the Brits had allowed poppy fields to encroach and little villages to encroach that perimeter fence line, right up to the fence line. And then there were other things, first line of defense things that were missing, like HESCO barriers, T-walls, and not a regular manning of towers. All those things came to play in this. And there was even a little shanty town that popped up right next to the main entrance gate to the base where all the deliveries came in for the troops. And so when Major General Gurganis got there, he said, hey, these poppy fields have to go. There was no open fields of observation or fire. And this shanty town has to be pushed back. And he got that pushback, but all the stuff they asked for, which was removal of the poppy fields, regular manning of the towers. There was a thing, a joint security agreement between the two national forces that split command, which was very suboptimal, and other things that were big problems, because the Taliban had planned the attack the year prior, basically, and they came in right where those poppy fields were that night. It was a very, very dark night, only 2% illumination. And they came right in that fence line and cut the wire. There was not a tower guard in the closest tower. The towers were kind of set back from the perimeter. And there were reports, because the towers were manned by third party Tongans, there were reports they weren't really doing their job very well. Mm. So, and not to mention, I'll add one thing, there had been security breaches before on that base, but there was a complacency that was alarming by the Brits. It was their base. They built it. We built a home there afterwards, called Camp Leatherneck. And there was just such a complacency that they wanted to befriend the people that were right next door to them watching daily operations, you know, that they were trying to make good with the Afghan locals while it was putting everybody on that base at risk.
I mean, yeah, so what we're saying is, because is it a meeting of perhaps two strategies? One's a sort of a hearts and minds policy that had been tried during previous conflicts, and that's the reason that those poppy shields should have been long gone, destroyed anyway. And the same thing with the shanty, with the towns on the town on the outside. Because though it might be look it's like sort of happy little children and people trying to catch cigarettes off you and the whole bits and pieces. Let's forget the Taliban are very much, you know, they've got people under duress. If you don't do what they say, they're going to basically do horrendous things to your nearest and dearest.
Absolutely. You know, they leverage that all the time, and they could go into those little those little villages bordering the perimeter and say, hey, you do this or we're going to kill you and your family. And so there was no ability to trust anybody living along that perimeter to keep the base safe. Obviously, that's kind of a ridiculous notion. You think of how they built castles in medieval times, ancient times. They'd build a moat around it, right? Mm-hmm. There was no moat, you know, a camp bastion on that eastern perimeter. And not to mention the terrain itself was undulating, where it had depressions, like the wadis. It's like a trench, kind of a big trench. And so when the Taliban approached that night, they hid in one of those wadis. So nobody could see them until they got in. So there's no, you know, hearts and minds is one thing. But the other thing is they're there. The number one goal when you send international forces to a foreign country is to protect those forces.
Maybe it's a conflict of approaches then, because they're thinking, well, mm-hmm. you know, because, hey, you know, we are being invited in by the, and it's a naivety, if you like, by certain people, because, you know, the British hadn't had the experience that, and I hate to drop the V word in now, but the Vietnam War before. And so the British hadn't had a conflict like that. The previous conflict the British had been involved in, apart from obviously peacekeeping duties and Sari in the Balkan states, had been with the Falklands. And that was, if you like, an old fashioned imperial war, empire war. However, you know, the Americans had had the experience that they'd had in the 60s and 70s in Vietnam. They knew what they were fighting about. They knew how counterinsurgency worked, even though the British Army had that in Malaya, of course, in the 50s. However, it was maybe some words that we'd be invited out. We should make friends with these people. And so therefore having a purely, and I know it says it's an oxymoron saying, but we should have a camp that is not purely defensive, so that we can converse and get intel off our Afghan neighbors.
Well, like I say, you know, you have to create a line of defense. I'll do another analogy. You know, I live in Southern California, and we have fires down here all the time. And you have to have build a line of defense around your house so the fire won't encroach your house if it comes near you. And by the time the attack on Camp Bastion happened, the British, the U.S. forces, anybody in the coalition knew the character of the enemy, knew that they would try anything, and they did succeed. They were a thinking, fierce enemy, the insurgencies. And it wasn't just the Taliban. It was Al-Qaeda and anybody else who wanted to come and take a shot at coalition forces. And so you have to have the imagination of everything is game for them. Nothing is off limits for them. They proved that very well, going into a major base full of Marines and thinking that, you know, they were going to come out alive. I mean, they had to know it was a suicide mission because Marines do what Marines do, and they did it amazingly well that night. Mm. So the whole thing I'm trying to say is you have to have observable fields of fire and observation when you are smack dab in the middle of enemy territory.
Perhaps one of the things Bastion was so big, and then, you know, the British said it was impregnable. So therefore there's a complacency. Mm-hmm. There's a like, oh, it's so big that they'd never think of attacking it because look at, you know, we've got 40 square miles of this thing. Even if they do try and attack, they'll get wiped off the planet quite quickly. There's that overconfidence perhaps, Jean.
Absolutely. That's not how our generals thought. That's not how they thought at all. The minute they got there, they saw problems and they started immediately trying to rectify those problems. And they were denied repeatedly. You have to realize that they were sent there to, it was an era of transition because troops were being taken out of Afghanistan. And so in March 2012, there were 17,000 U.S. Marines there. And by the end of September, there was supposed to be 7,400. So that took away a lot of manpower doing a lot of jobs, and the fighting had not stopped. Okay. They were still doing 24/7 counterinsurgency missions, close air support for the wing. And yet they were having to do the massive job of pulling out everything that they brought into that country and shipping it back home. Every little piece of metal, right? And so you've got a dual mission there and much less manpower. So there was no complacency on our American generals thinking, and we didn't give the Taliban that kind of trust. You know, it's like they'll do anything. And admittedly, it was a very bold move that they cut the wire and went on the base that night, and they found out otherwise that wasn't a very good thing to do, even though they did accomplish some real damage and killed two Marines that night, tragically.
Mm. What was the first indication then that they were going to come in? They were coming in over the wire, and this was a serious incursion.
When was an explosion? The first Harrier jet they blew up was the first indication, because I'll set the scene here too. It was 10 o'clock at night, and it was, like I say, a very unusually dark night. And so Marines are all over the airfield at that point. They're getting ready for the next shift. The air support was 24/7. So they're in their flight line spaces getting ready for that. They're over in the fuels area where the fuel farm is, where they fuel the aircraft. They're in the cryo lab where they do cryogenics there for the aircraft. They're at the gym. They're in the chow hall. They're in the LSAs and the sleeping quarters. So they're everywhere on the airfield. And everyone all over that airfield heard that first explosion. And they thought, oh, this is a controlled det, which a controlled det is when they gather enemy ordnance and they blow it up so the enemy can't use it. But they quickly realized, quickly got set to motion. This is an enemy. They're on base. They didn't know how many. They didn't know who it was. They didn't know where they were. And they had very few comms in the beginning. So it was quite a monumental challenge mobilize, come together, and hunt them down without killing friendlies below, and take out the threat.
Because obviously within the perimeter you've got as you said you've got various nationalities, you've got civilian contractors as well who are in there, you've got people who are working, and when you're working on the ground, and when you say Harriers, of course these are the Harriers of the US Marine Corps, because they were using Harriers at this point.
Yeah, there were different aircraft. There were the Harriers, which mm-hmm. the Taliban attacked first, but there were some investigations that happened 8 months down the road, and I'm not sure if we'll have time to talk to any about that. But there was one Taliban survivor, and he was interrogated after the attack. So the reason they came on the base, the plans were to destroy the jets, destroy the helos, and kill Marines that were in their tents, he said. So they call our living spaces tents. So that was their intent. And they started off with a bang, basically a very loud bang doing that. But they didn't get too far because our Marines became the first line of defense, where the other security gaps were not there, were either not in place or failed. And they became the first line of defense and prevented hundreds of what could have been a catastrophic situation. If the Taliban had gotten further, then they could have infiltrated Camp Leatherneck, the rest of Camp Bastion on the other side, on the west side. And you know, they had set fuel bags on fire, 50,000 gallon jet fuel bags on fire. If they would have found the bulk fuel storage with millions of gallons of fuel, the whole base could have gone up. So our troops saved thousands of lives and millions in equipment and infrastructure on that base with what they did.
What was the immediate reaction? Because I suppose it's a slice of luck in terms of the defenders that they run into the U.S. Marine Corps rather than, I don't know, somebody perhaps who wasn't as well trained . Should we talk about the esprit de corps of the Marine Corps? Because they are quite a body, aren't they?
They are quite a body. Every man's a rifleman in the Marine Corps. It's one of the only U.S. service unit that makes everybody who joins the Marine Corps have rifle proficiency. And that really came to play that night, because this was an aviation unit, and they had roles that were things like mechanics or metalsmiths, or they were logistics, or they were, you know, a pilot or crews, and all these different roles. And they were all picking up their rifles that night. And the esprit de corps is quite, it always inspires me, because they never leave a man behind, number one, but they run to the chaos. So they didn't hold back. They were out there picking up their rifles, looking for the enemy. And they were, first of all, protecting the civilians that were caught in it. And there were a group of civilians that were unarmed that had to be moved and kept and put in a safe place. And then they go out there to protect each other. They watch each other's backs. This is such a core principle of the esprit de corps in the Marine Corps. They watch each other's backs. No man does it alone. Mm. So it's a team effort. And it's just kind of a beautiful thing. It's like a brotherhood. They become this family. Even if they don't like each other personally, they're brothers, and they'll do anything, including giving their own lives to protect that brother.
And that's the thing. So they're highly motivated, morale is high, and they just basically go into what they've trained to do. There's no stepping back. And it's, you know, it's, and I know we're here, and, you know, we'll be marking the 40th anniversary of several things, 80th anniversary of several things over the summer, and then 45, obviously. But, you know, Marine Corps, especially in the Pacific Theater, absolutely, that was, if you like, the foundation of that working together. And so they've got a proud history that they're protecting as well.
Absolutely, Giles. I mean, the character of U.S. Marines that we saw in those World War II conflicts, Bella Wood, Iwo Jima, Guadalcanal. That character was taken into the War on Terror. And so, but the War on Terror is a different conflict than World War II conflicts or World War I. We were fighting uniformed national armies, right, in those wars. Here you're fighting a group of insurgents, urban warfare with, you know, no rules, no Geneva Convention, right? The Taliban, the Al-Qaeda, they make their own rules. And their tactics are just different. First of all, they normally hide in the population to plan their attacks, number one. And then you can't find them. It's like they've been called the ghost enemy because you don't know who is friend or foe with them. In World War II, you had a uniform, so you could pick out the enemy. Not the case, because they look like everybody else for the most part. And so that character was brought into the War on Terror all that time, all those years, and it still remains the same. That, I mean, if you watch any of the films made about World War II, and you see those Marines climbing up that hill in Iwo Jima and those Japanese are in those strongholds, it's mind-blowing what they'll do.
But again, it was, if you look at how those combats were, it was often with a hidden enemy, and it was often chaos, and it was confusion, and people were popping up all over the place. And that must have been pretty much the scenario in Camp Bastion as well, because obviously there is confusion, there are things exploding, there are people running around, nobody's sure what's going on, it's a dark night. You know, it is a perfect night for a clandestine attack. Did they get helicopters in the air? Did they get Harriers in the air? How did it pan out? I know we haven't got an awful lot of time, but just quickly, okay. I want to go on to the cover up as well. How did the attack pan out? And just tell me a little bit about the two Marines who were lost.
Okay. Well, like I said, everybody heard the blast, and so wherever they were on the airfield, they started mobilizing, and the Marine Corps has this thing called chain of command. So they're trained from top officer on down to, you know, Lance Corporal, how to operate in combat. If somebody gets taken out, then it goes down to the next person in charge. And that's what happened that night. But immediately the people on the east side, which is where there were flight lines, the Harriers, then the helicopters, and then the living quarters were right up to near that Flint's line of the Marine Corps, too, of the Marines that were there. And so immediately, Lieutenant Colonel Stephen Lightfoot, who was commander of HMLA 469, the helicopters, said, let's get these aircraft up. Mm-hmm. He saw the writing on the wall right away. He got his pilots and crews up in the air, number one, to keep them from getting blown up. Number one, to search and find the enemy. And number two, to keep them from getting blown up.
If they're in the air, they're harder to hit on. Let's face it, that's quite a very good move.
It's a very good move, but it was difficult because it was dark. And the fuel, the smoke from the fires kind of fogged out their night vision. And so the only way they could find the enemy was to determine by the color of the tracers, because enemy ammunition has green tracers, were red, NATO ammunition is red. And so they could only distinguish who were Marines and who were Taliban by the tracers in what direction they were shooting. So they found out the Taliban was shooting at the flight line, so they knew those weren't Marines, right? So that's how they picked them out, is by the color of the tracers. But the Harriers were already on fire. And not to mention, with close combat like that over an airfield with Marines all over the place, like a jet or an F-18 or anything that actually did get called up and come over, but they were turned away because the match of weapon to target below suited the helicopters better, because they could get in close, do less collateral damage. When you drop a bomb, there's going to be a lot of collateral damage, right?
Yeah, and also it'd be easy to identify a target, wouldn't it? If you're in a helicopter rather than if you have milliseconds as you literally slam over.
And that was the biggest thing on those pilots and crews' minds is to not shoot their own Marines or civilians down there. So they were very, very careful, and they finally did establish comms. And I will establish in the beginning, when the whole thing started rolling out, Lieutenant Colonel Chris Rabel, who was commander of the VMA 211, which was the Harrier squadron, he was down south in the living area and got immediately in a vehicle and drove up there, got on the flight line, found his Marines. They were in one of the hangars going kind of like, well, what do we do kind of thing. And he rounded them up and said, hey, you want to be a Marine? Let's go. In more colorful language. Okay. and so he led his Marines to battle that night. And, In the initial phase of the attack, when they didn't know where they were, how many, all that, even the weaponry, they weren't sure what they were equipped with. They did have RPGs and rifles. So when Lieutenant Colonel Rabel went outside with his Marines, he went in to get another group. And just at that time, one of the RPGs was launched that way, and he caught some shrapnel, and that killed him instantly. And there were some other Marines that were there observing. The first job of the Marines was to establish lines of defense, right, all over the airfield. And they caught some of that too, but they weren't killed. There was another Marine over on the west side in the logistics area, Sergeant Bradley Atwell, who also was trying to rally his men over there. And he ran up the flight line. Remember I said they run to chaos? He was running to the sound of the explosions, knowing there was an enemy on board, and he was shot and killed. So, but after that, and those were very, very tragic, after that, there was no more killing by the Taliban. We were doing the killing after that.
Isn't that just the thing about we say about the Marine Corps and that whole thing about running towards the danger when the natural human impulse is to get the hell out of Dodge, quote unquote, and rallying your guys. I mean that's the ethos going completely through there. We're not going to have an awful lot of time, unfortunately, but just the cover. I mean, my drawer dropped open just going through the first couple of pages of this, which I'm holding in my hot little hand, but. This is a story that should be enshrined in Marine Corps law, and it should also be an instruction manual about how not to have a base. If you're going to have a base in a hostile territory, don't let them build bleeding agricultural fields going all the way up to the gate. So why the cover up? Is it because of Benghazi had happened literally 3 days before and the powers that be couldn't afford the sort of morale boost, twisted morale boost that this would give Qaeda and the Taliban?
Well, you know, I don't really have a good answer for that, why they did what they did. But I do want to praise the British Defense Committee. There were two investigations, ours, the U.S. Army, and the British Defense, that launched 8 months after the attack when they instituted all the changes that our generals suggested before the attack. So that was kind of a mystery why that even happened. But the British Defense Committee were unexpected heroes. They came in and they talked to Lieutenant General Capewell, who was like our Secretary of Defense, the Ministry of Defense over there. And he stood there and denied responsibility. And they said, no, we don't get this. We want to know what we were responsible for and why these things were undone, basically. I was so impressed with not only the courage they had to own up to the British failures that night, because everybody was blaming our two generals and they lost careers that spanned over 70 years total, impeccable careers over this. It was one of those, somebody's head's got to roll and it was theirs. And it was like, they were the people trying to fix things. So, but the British Defense Committee was so amazing on how they opened it all up, and they wouldn't accept the fact that our two generals were only to blame. And someday I'd like to go to Britain and thank them all personally for doing that. I've got excerpts from their evidence session that where they were interviewing Lieutenant General Capewell and a couple other folks. And not just, there was, I think, about 10 members on the committee. And they all had these deep, digging, insightful questions that really brought to light the real story. Even though they had read the U.S. investigation, they were still saying, oh, this is not good enough. We want to know more. Why? They couldn't put two and two together in my mind that, hey, it was a British base, and you're saying we had absolutely no accountability for security on that base, which is what was said. And so they weren't content with that. And they went further. And at the end, it's also in my book, is some of their conclusions and the things that were done to rectify that after the attack.
The book is called Triumph Over the Taliban. It's by Gene McKinney, who's speaking today. Gene, if people want to find you online, where's the best place to go and find you?
They can go to Amazon, you know, and type in Triumph Over the Taliban, or they can go to my website, www.patriotprofileswithans.com. The book's there, the link's there, and they can get it there. And it's in three versions, Kindle, hardback, and paperback.
And you can also order it directly from our own virtual bookstore. I could have talked to you about this for the next 2 or 3 days, to be honest with you, Gene, but that's, as you know, the book is called Triumph Over the Taliban. It's by Gene McKinney. Go to the virtual bookstore and order it. I promise you, it's a brilliant read. Gene, thank you so much for your time today.
Well, thank you. I've really enjoyed this, and I appreciate your interest.